Good morning. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. It's 10:15. Thank you guys for all coming. It's the last day of Tech Ed, and at least it's not the first session of the day, so I don't know if this is your second session or the first one you attended, but I appreciate you coming. My name is Wade Wegner, and I am the CTO of Aditi Technologies. Aditi Technologies is a national solutions integrator, so a consulting company, and until recently, probably about 3 months ago, I worked for Microsoft. I was a technical evangelist on the Windows Azure evangelism team. So if you've heard my name before, it may surprise you that I'm not with Microsoft, but I did just recently make a change. However, I am still going to talk to you about building mobile applications that leverage services in Windows Azure. And I've given this talk a few times before. One of the exciting pieces about the talk this time is we're able to take it to the next level given some of the announcements that were made last week at Meet Windows Azure and some of the new capabilities of the Windows Azure platform. So even if you've seen me give this talk before or you've heard something, seen a talk or someone's spoken to you about Windows Azure and mobile applications, there's probably going to be a few new twists because of some of the new capabilities that have been released recently. So we'll go through that and should be a good time. So we're going to have a number of demos. In fact, I've got quite a lot to show. Everything we're going to talk through, I'm going to try to reinforce and validate through some sort of a demonstration. And most of everything, I've also published these demos up in GitHub, so I'll share some pointers to those things. So if you just want to grab the end state and give these things a try yourself, you're going to be able to at the end. So without further ado, so we're going to talk about device apps. And I specifically want to call this out as device or mobile applications because there's nothing that precludes, let's say, a Windows 8 machine and building out some sort of Metro-styled app from using these same patterns. Nothing prevents an iOS or Android device from doing the exact same thing. In fact, I'm going to show you some resources where the team that I formerly was on has built out native libraries and resources that you can use to tap into the exact same services running in Windows Azure. So even though I'm going to be focused mostly demonstrating from Windows Phone today, you can use just about any kind of device platform that can speak HTTP. So really want to reinforce that message. Having these services deployed in the cloud opens up these opportunities. Now, we're going to walk through four particular areas today. We're going to talk a lot about storage and how from a device you can interact with cloud storage. And not just interact with it, but interact with it in a secure way. So we're going to spend a lot of time about some best practices to where you put storage keys, how you interact with them, how you can give the user the best experience possible when communicating from a device that's on a network, on a cellular network, and giving them access to these storage resources that they'll need. We're going to talk through identity and some different tactics and some different services that you can use in order to provide identity services to your users. And we'll give a lot of examples. And I actually have some new stuff, too, that uses some of the ASP.NET web APIs to take some of these tokens that we get from our identity providers and parse them. So pretty neat stuff. We'll talk through some communication patterns. In fact, two different communication patterns that are available for mobile clients. And then lastly, we're going to wrap up with some of the services that come with the Windows Azure platform that are really compelling from a device or a mobile application perspective. So those are all the different things we're going to talk about. And along the way, we're going to go through demos as well. And apologies, this monitor kind of blocks me off from this side of the room. So if you guys don't see me, I'll try to walk over here once in a while. So again, these are the four different buckets that we're going to talk through today. And we'll get started with storage. Apologies. First, a couple of different positioning statements around device and cloud, and then Windows Azure actually makes sense. The first is the cloud really opens up some new application scenarios. If you think about what you have available on the device, you really have a very constrained environment in terms of processing power, storage. Oftentimes, you don't have network connectivity, et cetera. So by leveraging resources in the cloud on the device, you really open up yourself to new opportunities. And I don't think I need to convince anyone here in the audience that the marriage of mobile and cloud is a good one. So I'm guessing most of you buy into that, or you probably wouldn't be here. But it's definitely a sweet spot leveraging both of these things together. The cloud also leverages the playing field. If you think about the fact that you can go and instantly provision however many services you need, levels the playing field between you, where you may be a startup, and the big boys that actually have, you know, lots of money where they can go and provision and purchase and have that capital expense to get the resources they need. So it really opens up a lot of possibilities. In fact, if most of you, I would be surprised if most of you already aren't somehow using cloud to back some apps that you're building. Because, you know, the fact that cloud computing provides a pay-as-you-go method really makes it a compelling value proposition for it. And the fact that you're using the cloud also means that you're everything's service-oriented, you're talking HTTP, et cetera, so it provides a really natural way to open up the services and the resources that you build to different device platforms. So it kind of forces you along a path of making some good choices about how you go about building your systems. Now, with Windows Azure, there's a couple of other things. Now, until recently, we would speak largely about PaaS, about how Windows Azure is a platform as a service that allows you to provision web roles where you have a set of resources available to you that you can take your applications, build these applications, and then deploy them into Windows Azure. And that's great because Windows Azure web roles do a number of things such as automatic OS patching, so you don't have to worry about updating the Windows OS. It'll actually do self-healing so that if something happens to the machine and the machine goes down, Windows Azure will ensure that one of your instances is always running, and the Fabric Controller will then spin up another instance as well. And it gives you that elasticity and scale that you need by kind of shooting you in a model of building stateless web applications that then can scale horizontally within your cloud services. Now, what's really interesting is this is all still true, but we've also now opened up Windows Azure websites. Now, Windows Azure websites, if you guys aren't familiar with it, was announced last week, and Bill Staples did a fabulous talk on Monday, in which he went through kind of ad nauseum all the capabilities of Windows Azure websites. In a quick summary, what Windows Azure websites provides you with is a new way to deploy your applications and a new way in which they're hosted. So you actually can leverage things like Git, TFS, Web Deploy, FTP as a way to take your application and publish it into a Windows Azure website. And then you have two options in terms of how you have that application hosted. You can actually host it in a multi-tenant high-density service along with other tenants to keep the costs down. So it can either be free or a very, very low cost, which is really compelling for mobile app developers that may start off with almost no users whatsoever. So the ability to get something instantly deployed with very little cost is a significant capability that wasn't in the platform before and really was probably the number one ask of mobile developers, was give us something where we can very quickly deploy our assets into the cloud and keep it really low cost. So Windows Azure websites provides that. It also provides the ability to set off reserve instances of your websites so that not only do you have the easy way of instantly deploying your application into Windows Azure websites, but you can say, you know what, I don't want to run it in a multi-tenant instance. I want to run it in my own reserve instance so that I have my own resources and I'm not going to be potentially affected by other people. So there's these two different models now. There is a cost associated with that reserved instance, but you know, if that's something that you need, you can opt into it and pay for it. So Windows Azure websites provides a lot of new opportunities. And all the demos that I'm going to be showing today, I'm actually going to be using Windows Azure websites as a way of deploying the services that I'll use with my mobile applications. So now a couple of other things is that, and we'll get to this at the end, there are a lot of additional services in the Windows Azure platform that you can use as a developer that makes a lot of different things easy. So for instance, the Access Control Service really helps with federating identity and outsourcing identity to different identity providers so that you don't have to worry about managing identity. Caching, there's a distributed caching service that you can tap into so you can really reduce the time in which a user has to wait if you're going back and calling some data that often gets called in your application. There's a content delivery network in which you can cache static data. And then also there's a service called Traffic Manager. And Traffic Manager allows you to do load balancing across data centers and cloud services. And that's really compelling when you start thinking about building a mobile application that targets a global audience. Rather than having someone download your application and try to hit a service running in North America, you could actually point it to a Traffic Manager URI, or an endpoint, that then figures out which data center is closest to that user and route them accordingly. So Traffic Manager provides a lot of capabilities. But we'll get into this a little bit more detail later. But if you're really wondering why Windows Azure instead of AWS or instead of GoDaddy or whatnot, this is exactly why Windows Azure is compelling for mobile apps. So without further ado, we're going to talk a little bit more about storage. Now, within Windows Azure, there's actually four different buckets. You could say five or maybe even six now, so it gets more and more complex. But these are some of the traditional data storage types within Windows Azure. Within the Windows Azure Storage Service, you've got tables, blobs, and queues. Now, a table is a non-relational table. Think of it more as key-value pairs. So if you've got a bunch of structured data, not relational data, but structured data that you want to store and then be able to get access to, Windows Azure Tables is a great place to do it. You partition that data up front so that it becomes extremely performant on select. So if you define the right partitioning scheme within Windows Azure Tables, you can get data out of it really quite fast. So Windows Azure Tables is a great place for structured data. Windows Azure Blobs are what you would think about when you hear the word blob. It's binary data. Think of it as images or videos. Those sorts of resources you can attach, put into a container, and put up in cloud storage. What's interesting to note, too, is Windows Azure Blobs gives you a way to take your container that has blobs and attach it directly to a CDN. So if you want to start caching this type of data worldwide, you can directly associate it to a content, the Windows Azure Content Delivery Network. Windows Azure Queues gives you a way to do some sort of asynchronous messaging between your tiers. So you can actually then, say, write a work item into a queue and then have some sort of back-end processing being responsible for dequeuing that information and then doing some sort of work on it. There's also, and the reason I said that there's arguably five is there's also service bus message queues, which you can do something very similar. And then lastly, there's SQL Azure, or actually SQL Database. SQL Database is a relational database service based off a SQL Server running up in Windows Azure. So if you actually want to use relational data, if you need to be able to do queries or joins or some sort of aggregation, you can do that within Windows Azure SQL Database. So that option is available as well. Now, despite all of these things, there's a couple of things you need to keep in mind is, in order to get access to these resources, you need to have a secret. There's a secret that you use in order to get access to it. With SQL Server, you're probably familiar with a connection string, right? You're going to have a connection string with a SQL login and a password. And that's going to be your secret when you connect to SQL Azure SQL Database. Similarly, with Windows Azure Storage, you have this concept of a primary and secondary access key that you use to sign the request header. So you actually create a signature that gets embedded in the request. Now, the reason for this is all your data is secured up in storage. And so you sign the request so that the storage service understands that you should have access to this resource. So the question always becomes, all right, I've got a key. Where do I put the key? A lot of people make the mistake of just taking this key that they get out of Windows Azure Storage Service and putting the key on the device. And that's a big no-no because as soon as you end up putting that key on the device, I guarantee someone's going to find a way to sideload, bootstrap, whatever, that application, reverse, decompile it, and get your key. And as soon as that key gets out, your key is no longer a secret. So we're going to talk through a couple of patterns where you can keep that key secure somewhere else but still benefit from it, not have to proxy all your requests through a service running somewhere else. So just note that storage secrets are very important within the platform. And again, once you share your secret, meaning once you put it in your app and deploy it, it's no longer a secret. So how do we keep them secret? Generally, what we end up doing is we proxy the requests. So you can think about a case where I've got a web role, or I've got my website running somewhere in the cloud. I've got my mobile application, and then I've got my data stored in, let's say, it could be Windows Azure Storage, it could be table storage, it could be SQL Azure. The pattern is very, very simple. When you make a request, you'll make a request directly to the service. Now, the key isn't on the device. The key is actually in the service. So when you make the request to the service, it's the actual service, in the web role or your website, that takes the key and generates a request to the storage service and creates the signed request. So it will then make the request to the storage service using that key. So you note in this pattern, the key never leaves your service. So it doesn't make it to the device. You don't end up potentially having a case where someone gets that key from your device. So you basically proxy it. And then, of course, like I said, this would also work with tables or blob storage, et cetera. So very generic pattern, and I'll show you the implementation of this in a moment. Now, we also have the concept of a shared access signature. And some of you may be familiar within Windows Azure Storage that the shared access signature was only available until recently just for blobs. They actually announced just a few days ago at TechEd that There's now shared access signature support for blobs, tables, and queues, and this is great. And I'll show you why this makes a difference, because in the last scenario where I'm proxying the whole request, let's say I wanted to upload an image. I'm actually taking that image and passing it off to a service, all that binary data, and then that service has to then again take all that binary data and put it into the storage service. So we're passing it through an intermediary, which could potentially slow things down and create a less performant application for the user. We want to get out of the way of the user as much as possible and let the device go to the storage service, but in a secure way. So with a shared access signature, it goes somewhat like this. The client, the device, is going to call out to your service and say, hey, please generate for me a shared access signature that I can use for a period of time. And the web role or your service has the key in it, and it's able to generate the shared access signature that it then passes back to the device. Now, the shared access signature itself, at the end, is nothing more than a URI. So it's just a URL that's got some components attached as query string parameters, and then it's got a hash attached at the end that's an encrypted hash of all the parameters that you had passed back to you. So that URL is then passed to the device, and when it wants to upload something into Windows Azure Storage, be it a blob like an image or write something to a table or to a queue, it will address the storage service with that URL. And so by doing that, what's going to happen then is the storage service will say, hey, this request came in and they passed me this shared access signature. So the storage service will take a look at all the components in the query string, recompute the hash based on the key, and then do a comparison to make sure that user actually provided the right credentials in order to access it. If the values match, then the storage service knows that this user should have access to this resource and will let them upload, download, et cetera, that data. So here's a pattern where we're able to get out of the way of our mobile application securely. We didn't have to put the key on the device. We're able to leave the key in the service, do a very quick call to get that shared access signature, which, by the way, we can cache on the device for a period of time until it expires, and then we can just start addressing storage directly using that shared access signature. And then, of course, we can get a response back if we want to. So shared access signatures are a very, very important concept when it comes to mobile clients interacting with the storage service. The idea, again, is get out of the way as much as possible of sending your data and interacting with data on your client. If you don't have to proxy through a service, don't. And, of course, just really quickly, this pattern works for SQL Azure as well, although note that there are no shared access signatures for SQL Azure. But with SQL Azure, you would essentially proxy the call with a standard service. It could be a web API, it can be an OData service, or whatever it might be. So you can use this pattern with SQL Azure. Now, the one other interesting thing to note, too, is, again, I alluded earlier that a mobile device doesn't have a lot of computing power, right? So there may be cases where you want to do some sort of computation. Maybe you take a picture and you want to do some sort of analysis of it to find, you know, faces within it, or you want to process some video or something. And if you don't have a lot of computing power, you don't want to drain the battery, you can offload that work. So you could use a pattern like the shared access signatures to essentially get access to a queue, and then just write a work item into that queue. So just basically say, put a pointer in there so that a worker role or some sort of back-end processor also dequeues that message and then does something with it. It knows to process an image that you've uploaded or something else. So this is a very, very common pattern to use to offload some more compute-intense activities or some sort of aggregation of data that you've collected from a device. All right, so with that, I'm going to demonstrate some of this stuff. So I'll flip over here. And is that is not me. VGA2. That's me. So let's get started. Just so you know, what I've done, I have a storage account that I've created. In case any of you haven't already gone to the portal, just if you go to manage.windowsazure.com, you can log in with a live ID. There is a free trial you can get access to. It is capped. That's actually a really important thing. A lot of people get concerned about setting up a free trial account and having to enter a credit card. And I mean, I understand the concern. One of the most important updates made last December for the platform was having capped free trials. So basically what that means is unless you remove the cap, you will never get charged beyond what's available to you in the free trial. So you'll always have a zero balance. Still, you can be cautious if you like, but you don't have to be afraid to use the free trial. If you don't remove that cap, you won't get charged for anything within Windows Azure. So gives you an opportunity to play with some of these things a little bit. So I've created a storage account. I actually haven't done anything with it yet. but we're gonna use it today. So what I'm gonna do is create a new project, and I'm gonna create a Windows Phone project. And what I'm gonna demonstrate is essentially using the camera capture task to take a picture, and then I wanna upload that picture to blob storage, and then I also wanna write a pointer into table storage that identifies where my image is. And the reason is, you can certainly enumerate your blobs within Windows Azure Blob Storage, but oftentimes you want to have some additional metadata around that. You might say, I don't know, like, hey, this is a picture of me, you know, playing at a park or something like that. And there's additional metadata that you may want to associate with the picture. So putting it in a table gives you a lot of opportunities to put additional metadata around that. And then you have a pointer back to that question. I just chose the Windows Phone application, and then I chose Windows Phone OS 7.1, which is the Mango release, so Windows Phone 7.5. So let me do that again real quick. What's that? Same for all devices. This would work for any Mango Windows Phone application. If I wanted to do an iOS application or Android, I would use Eclipse or Objective-C within Xcode. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but this is specific. I'm going to be building specifically a Windows Phone application. Right now I'm just going to focus on Windows Phone. I'm going to end up building some services that I deploy to Windows Azure, and those services will be consumable by any device platform. So I'm just, for the sake of demonstrating, I'm just going to be using Windows Phone here for a moment. So let me get into it, and hopefully it'll be a little bit clearer as we go. The first thing I'm going to do is just add some controls here that I can use to not only initiate the capture of the image, but then name it as well. So I'm going to use a stack panel. And then I'm going to add a text box and a button. Then I'm going to use a couple events here as well. So I'm going to load some stuff up on unloaded for the page, and then also when the button gets clicked. So get a couple of these things here. Now I'm going to use as part of the Windows Phone SDK. There's a camera capture task. Call this camera capture task, and then as part of loaded, I'm going to go ahead and instantiate this. So camera task equals new. Task, and then camera capture task dot completed. All right, so now I've got an event handler for it as well. So basically, once it captures the image from the camera capture task, then I'm going to be able to run some code. Now, in order to start this, I'll just go to my camera capture task and show. And essentially, I mean, this is pretty straightforward. If I go ahead and run this, it's not going to do a whole lot right now, but at the very least, what I'll be able to do is use the onboard camera and the emulator to take some pictures. So we'll show you this real quick. All right, I can put in a name. You'll see here it'll pop up the camera. Go ahead and accept it, and there we go, and that's firing the event. So that's just the first step. So the next thing we need to do is I'm going to put some error handling in here. So basically, if it's the result is okay and we have an image that's been selected, we want to do something with it. Now, what I'm going to do is take this image and upload it into blob storage. So I want to take what I have here and throw it in a container and make it available up in Windows Azure Storage. Now, to do that, what I'm going to do is actually grab a NuGet package that has a library that makes it really easy for me to interact with Windows Azure Blob Storage. And this is available for everyone. It's provided by Microsoft. And it's Windows Azure, no, it's just phone.storage. So I'm going to install this, and this is going to give me pretty much everything I need in order to interact with it. Now, we'll get back to this in a moment, but one of the things to be very aware of is there's something called a storage initializer here. And we'll get back to this in a moment, and it'll be important to understand why this matters. But what I want to point out is right now the storage initializer is defaulting to using local storage. So it actually, if you see here, it's using this development storage account resolver. So that is, along with Windows Azure, the Azure SDK, you get a storage emulator. And so by default, we're going to use the local storage emulator. So it makes local development really easy. We'll change this as we move forward later. So now that I've got that NuGet package installed, we're going to start working with blob storage. And so essentially, I've got some code here. Let me show you what this is. So I'm creating a blob client, and I'm going to grab the cloud storage context. And this actually is, let me do a build. And this context is actually part of the NuGet package. So it's part of the Windows Azure Samples phone storage assembly. So essentially what this is doing is it's going to go to the resolver and say, create me a blob client that I'm going to end up using throughout this operation. And then I create a container reference. So when I end up uploading it, the blobs actually get attached to containers. And so here it's going to get attached to this Pix container. And then from there on out, it's pretty straightforward. We'll say container create if not exist. So if it doesn't exist, go ahead and create it. The access type is just a straight container. And then essentially I have a response here as well. So when I get the reference to the blob that gets uploaded, it's going to be named based on the image name that I provide. And the image name is coming from that text box I added. And then it's going to use the upload from stream, take the photo stream from the capture camera task event, and it's going to go ahead and upload that. So that's going to get our image up in blob storage. The next step is I want to be able to take the blob URI where I stored it and then add that into Windows Azure Tables so that I get an index of everything that I have within Windows Azure Tables. And so there I'm going to use a table client. This is very similar. I'm going to get the cloud table client using the resolver, and then I'm going to name a table name, and I'll again create table if not exists for the table name. And then I'm going to create something called sample data, which is basically just a class that I can store up in table storage, and I'm going to go ahead and add that. Now, sample data doesn't exist, so I'm going to go ahead and just generate a class for that. And this is a lot of just code to write here, so I've got another snippet for it. And essentially, this, if you've done any sort of work with Windows Azure Storage and use the Windows Azure Storage SDK, you'll note that this is pretty much the same concept. You basically create a class of the table service entity type. And this defines all the partition key, row key, all the timestamp, et cetera, all those things that are required as part of data that gets stored within Windows Azure Tables. And you'll note I also have created a name and a URL key. So this way I can take the name of my image, store it in name, and then the URI for my blob I'll also put in there. So a little bit of code. Let me just go ahead and compile this, and we'll go ahead and run it, and that way you guys can see what it looks like when we get it running. So get this started up. All right, now, so that I can show you what's going on here as well, I'm using a free tool created by Neudesic, actually, David Paulman. It's a great tool. It's called Azure Storage Explorer. And, I'm going to go ahead and, I want to select it. Okay, there we go. So this is just going to give me a way to visually show what's in my blob containers and in tables. So you know, right now I don't have anything in blobs, so I'm going to go ahead and say, you know, image1.jpg. And we're gonna essentially capture the image, accept it, and away it goes. So essentially now I should have put a breakpoint in there, but essentially it's created the blob client, it's uploaded it, and then it's also taken the URI that was generated and thrown it into table storage. So we can do a refresh. You'll see it created my Pix container, and here's my image. I can take a look at this image if I want to. It's not a very interesting image since it's here we go. This is the default image that gets generated as part of the phone SDK. But then in addition to throwing that up into blob storage, you'll see that it also created a Pix table, and you'll see here's my item within the Pix table. So we've essentially, from the phone, been able to write directly to our local storage emulator, and that's great. Now, we need to take this a few different steps, because before, the first thing we need to do is get off of the storage emulator, because we really want to be writing to Windows Azure Storage. But we also want to do it in such a way that we aren't putting the key on the device. So we've got a couple of additional steps here to take, and we'll walk through that now. So the first step is going to be to create a set of services that we can use to proxy. So I'm going to create a new project, and I'm going to choose MVC4. And it doesn't really matter what you choose. I'm going to go ahead and choose empty. And I'm going to grab a NuGet package that's going to help us out here. So there is another NuGet package called, Windows Azure Storage. Now, the Windows Azure Storage Library is used here and will get pulled down. This is the official storage SDK provided by the Windows Azure Storage team. What I'm also going to grab is something called windows azure.storage.proxy. Now, what the proxy does, if you remember the patterns that I showed before, this proxy NuGet package creates a set of services that will proxy the requests from the phone to storage. In addition to proxying, it also provides a shared access signature service so that I can just make a request to that service and get a shared access signature that then I can use to upload my image. So we'll walk through that. Oops, I'm sorry. You got to choose the right project to target. So once this is installed, we're going to make a couple of updates now. I'm going to go ahead and build real quick. And then let me show you that. Fat fingered it. Thank you. I heard someone yell out four. In the storage service that's part of these proxy services, I want to point something out first, is that by default, we're also going to target development storage. So we're going to take this in steps. So what we're going to do now is have a service that is also talking to local storage, but we're going to now update our phone client to talk to these services. So instead of directly talking to our storage emulator, we're going to go through the service and use that as a proxy. So that means we're going to come over back to the storage initializer that's part of the phone, and we're going to make a quick change. We're going to comment out the default resolver, and we're going to use this resolver right here. And you'll see that what this is doing is it's addressing localhost and at a port. Now, by default, 81 is what's used within Windows Azure. I'm not using Windows Azure, so let me go ahead into properties on my MVC app and choose a specific port, and I'm just going to update this real quick so that we're going to the right place. We'll do a build, and then let's go ahead and run the service. Now remember, the phone now is not going to be talking directly to storage any longer. It's going to talk to the service, and when I start the phone, now we'll do test2.jpg, upload that, okay, and then come back in here. Let's look at blobs, and you can see now test2. So it didn't come from the phone. It came from the service. So our service is actually now acting as an intermediary between us and storage. So that's great. That's exactly what we want to have, because we can address the service without having to put the keys on the device. So that's first step. Now what we want to do is switch it so that instead of hitting local storage from our service, we want to address our storage instance. So it's pretty simple. We're going to come here to our storage service within our storage services class. And instead of using the development storage, we're going to use a storage account. I'm not going to scroll all the way over because you'll see it uses my account name and then my key, so I kind of want to keep it hidden there. But essentially, now I'm going to set it such that when I go to interact with storage, it's going to interact with the storage service out in Windows Azure. So let's fire this up one more time. Start the service. Didn't make any changes to the phone app, so I'm just going to go ahead and run this again. We'll call this test3.jpg. Accept, it'll upload, and I got an exception. What was it? Got a not found. Let me see if I actually have the right storage name in there. Wade Tech Ed. Let's look here. Wade Tech Ed. That looks right. I think that's right. Let's try it one more time. Let me just redeploy my phone app in case there was something cached in that app. I'll test 4, JPG. Okay. And let's refresh. And there's test 4. I wonder if something was cached, and you see test 3 actually got there, so I'm not entirely sure what it missed, but I'll just attribute it to the demo gods. But the idea is now that we've updated our storage services, so it's addressing our deployed storage account. So it uploaded test 4 now. Instead of 2, if we come over back to dev storage and do a quick refresh, you'll see test 3 and test 4 aren't there. They're actually in our deployed, our actual Windows Azure storage service. And same with our tables here. So let's query our picks. And we've got both of these items here as well. So that's exactly what we want to see. Now we'll take it one step further, and we're going to take the services that we've created in our project and deploy them up into Windows Azure so that we're not running anything locally other than the phone app. So to do this, I'm going to come back to the portal. And if you haven't tried this already, this is pretty neat. So come to the portal and go to websites. I've been using Wadetest 1, but I'm going to go ahead and create a brand new website. And we'll do a quick create, and we'll call this WadeTechEd. And we're going to use the East region. And it'll take a few moments, and it'll go ahead and create this. Now, one of the really nice things about this is once it's created, it'll also create a published profile setting for us that we can use to make it really simple to download. So I'm going to grab this download published profile, and then so it's saved it. Let's take this and just put it on my desktop. Get rid of this old one. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back to my web app and click Publish and import that published profile. And you can see here it's preloaded everything for me. It's got the URL for me. It's got a password that I can use to authenticate to it, etc. And I'm going to go ahead and say Next. I just tend to always say remove additional files because as I go to republish, I want to make sure that it gets rid of whatever was there before it does a republish, and then go ahead and publish. And so it's going to take this and deploy it up into my website. And once that's done deploying, it should open up the website. I'll be able to grab the URL. So here we go. So it's pretty darn quick. So grab that URL. Now I'm going to come back to my phone app, and under the storage initializers, instead of addressing this locally, we're going to address the deployed service. We'll rebuild, and then we'll start a new instance of that app. And I forget what test number we were on, so I think test 6 should work. Accept that. And should see test 6. So pretty straightforward, and I don't know if you guys have ever tried this in the past with Windows Azure or another provider, but this is pretty cool. So on the device now, we're able to send an image, it could be a video, it could be anything, as well as then write to a table to index the item that we've uploaded, get it directly into a published Windows Azure storage account securely by using some services running in a website. And you note that the website that I'm running here, if you come to configure, you'll see by default I'm running, is it scale? Yeah, it's scale. I'm running as a, it's reserved. You could run it as a shared instance as well. I don't know why it defaulted to reserved. But it would work as a shared instance as well so that the shared instance, you get up to 10 of these shared instances for free. There is some throttling in terms of total storage and resources available to you. But if you're just building some lightweight services for phone, especially if your phone, your application hasn't taken off, you haven't made a lot of money on it, it's a great way to get started. So that's the first demonstration around storage. So hopefully that reinforces some of the patterns and some of the things that we talked through earlier. All right, so we'll get back to the deck here. So the next thing we're going to talk about is identity. So you'll note that on the phone client in that scenario, in that application, we have no context of the user as an identity. We're making sure that there's secure connection to our service, but that's available to everyone. So there may be cases where we want to authorize certain users to be able to do certain things or to get access to information that only they should have access to. And so, incorporating identity into the phone is the way to do it. Typically, we'll end up seeing three different ways in which people go about doing this. The first is kind of rolling your own. Most people are familiar with this. You download an application. The first thing you do when you open it is it asks you for your username and password. And that's because the application provider is storing the username and password somewhere and going to be doing some sort of, when you log in, it's going to actually check to see if that you're a valid user. There's been some recent, very public issues that we've seen crop up around this where people don't manage passwords appropriately. And one of the downfalls of rolling your own is you are now responsible for managing securely your users' passwords. And not just managing the passwords, but what happens when they forget the password? Well, you need to provide a way for them to go reset or remember what their password is. Or there's a whole bunch of things that you end up having to now provide because you're managing those usernames and passwords. So there's some complexity. There's certainly a lot of flexibility with it, but there's also some complexity with that approach. One of the more common ones that I've seen too, at least in the areas that I run, is using ASP.NET membership providers as a way to do this. And with Windows Azure, you can certainly create a custom membership provider that uses Windows Azure Storage or even SQL Azure as a way to accomplish this. Now, another option here is to actually use an existing identity provider. So this could be using Live ID within your application, using Facebook, using ADFS, and actually using a corporate account. And this is actually really nice because now you're outsourcing the responsibilities of identity to that provider. So you don't have to worry about managing the usernames and passwords. You assume that Active Directory knows what it's doing and can probably do a better job of it than you can. Same with Facebook, Live ID, and so forth. At least one hopes. Part of the challenge here, though, is now that you're taking a direct dependency on that identity provider, you have to basically develop against their protocol. And if any of you, built apps for Facebook over the last several years, it's gotten a lot better, but probably remember that identity protocol changed quite a bit, and you had to make updates quite often. So there's some complexity around that as well. Certainly there's advantages, but there's complexity. The third option is basically outsourcing identity management altogether, and the Access Control Service does a great job of this. So the idea is now that we're not only going to leverage different identity providers, but we're going to let the Access Control Service be responsible for interacting with them. I'm only going to interact with the Access Control Service and basically federate through these other identity providers by using the Access Control Service. It's all claims-based. You can interact with tokens. It's a great way to approach it, and I'll show some demonstrations of it. If you want more information about the Access Control Service, I'm not going to get extremely deep or provide a lot of background in this talk. I'll show you how to use it, and I think that'll be an effective way to get introduced to it if you haven't seen it before. But I highly encourage you to take a look at the talks by Vittorio Bertacci. He's a principal program manager on the identity team, and he looks after Windows Identity Foundation as well as the Access Control Service. So he's given a talk here at TechEd. I think it was yesterday morning. If you didn't see it, I'm sure you can get it on demand. But he provides a great background to the Access Control Service. And so what I'm going to do is show a scenario where we're going to use the Windows Azure Access Control Service to federate to different identity providers. We're going to build a Windows Phone application. And not only are we going to authenticate on the phone through ACS, but we're going to take the OAuth token from ACS and pass it back to a web API service that will validate that token. And the reason I want to take it that extra step is it's one thing to just auth on the device, but as soon as you call into the services, you want to make sure that the user is authorized, it's a valid user, and the token that they're passing is, in fact, a valid token provided by the identity provider. So there's a few steps here, but I think this is a pretty compelling scenario that's worth going through. So, and let's make sure. There's actually a number of steps here. So if I do forget something, I have notes to refer to. All right, let me close some of this stuff down. All right. So we're going to create a new project. Yes. And we're going to start with a Windows Phone application. So the first thing I'm going to do is, the teams have provided, Microsoft has provided a starting point, because one of the complexities here, as you'll see, is we want to be able to interact with different identity providers, and all of these things are managed at the Access Control Service. And so one of the things that's provided as a NuGet here are some controls that make it really easy to render the different identity providers that have been attached to your Access Control Service. So the very first thing I'm going to do is install a NuGet package, and it is phone.identity.accesscontrol.basepage. So we'll add that, and as that's installing, what I'm going to do here is come back to the portal, and you'll see I'm in the old portal. So this is the new portal, manage.windowsazure.com. This is the old portal. It's windowsazure.com. The reason there's two portals right now is some of the services haven't yet been snapped into the new portal, and it's just a point-in-time issue. I guarantee you know, because I know some of the people on the teams. They are bringing this to the new preview portal. But for now, if you want to work with the Access Control Service, you still just go to Windows Azure or windows.azure.com. And I created ahead of time, but I haven't touched it since. I created this morning this Access Control Service namespace called Wade TechEd. So I'm going to come in here and get this configured such that we can use it for federating identity. Now, oh, I'm sorry, NuGet package. So, oh, what did I get? I got, here, let me come back to this. I grabbed phone.identity.accesscontrol.basepage. I actually have a lot of this stuff blogged up on my iBlog as well. I can provide some pointers to that at the end. Sure. So I'm going to set up and configure the access control service namespace now. One thing I want to point out first is I'm going to do this through the portal, but the portal is interacting actually with a management service. So everything you do in the portal, you could script out and automate as well. So whereas it may look like a lot of little works and tasks that I end up doing here, you can automate all of this so that you could run a script, a PowerShell script, and have this done for you. But we're going to do it by hand so that I can talk about it. Now, by default, LiveID is added as an identity provider. We're going to go ahead and add a few more. I'm going to add Google as an identity provider because I want people to be able to use their Google IDs. And then I'm going to add Yahoo as well. Now, I could add Facebook, but that would mean I just have to do another step now because then I have to get a Facebook application ID and such and blah, blah, blah. Trust me, it works. I'm not going to do it here right now. Same for Active Directory. I could get the WS Federation metadata URL endpoint, plug it into here, and set up an ADFS server as well. It works. You can trust me, but I don't have an ADFS server at my disposal right now. So I'm just going to create Google, Windows Live ID, and Yahoo. Now, the next step is I need to create a relying party. Now, a relying party is essentially the configuration that's going to be specific to my application that's interacting with the access control service, so the phone app that we're building. So I'm going to create a new relying party here, and I'm just going to call it Wade Tech Ed. And there's a realm, so I'm going to call the realm just, we'll call it Windows Phone for now. And I'll show you where we use these resources in a moment. So I'm going to name this relying party Wade Tech Ed, and I'm going to give it a realm of URI Wade's phone. Now, the other thing that I want to do is change the token format. We're going to use the simple web token, which provides back an OAuth token for us to interact with. That's really the easy way to do this over REST and with REST services is using that simple web token. You can change the lifetime of it if you want. You could bump that up so that the token is valid longer. We want to make sure that it's specified for these identity providers, and we're going to go ahead and save that. And so, essentially, that creates our relying party. Did I hit save? Oh, sorry. I need to generate a signing key. And then I can save it. All right, so we've created my relying party. The last thing we need to do is create some rules and groups. Now, what this is if you consider the fact that the access control service is handling the federation to other identity providers, we essentially need to create the rules that map specific metadata from one identity provider to the metadata that I'm going to use. So you can think about it as basically transforming a token that comes from Google, or transforming a token that comes from LiveID, or transforming the token from Yahoo into the token that my app is going to work with. And this is kind of the beauty of it, because the access control service is managing all that for me. All I care about is the token I get from the access control service. So I'm going to go ahead and add a new rule group. Oops, I'm going to use the default rule group. And fortunately, I can just click generate. And what generate will do is pretty much generate the default rule mappings that I need. And basically saying, hey, we're going to map the Google email address as the email address in the token that we hand to your app and so forth. So very, very straightforward stuff. Nothing particularly complex there. We'll save that. And at this point, we've configured the access control service. Now, I know it seems like maybe a number of steps. Typically, you do this once. We wouldn't have to do this again. And again, everything is scriptable, so it doesn't take that much time. So we've got ACS set up. Let's go back to our application. So now that the NuGet package has been installed, it's added a few resources for us. It's added a login page, and the login page is what has some controls set up there so that it can basically handle the login for us. And then it's also got a access control resource. And it's here where we're going to specify the values that we just generated here in the access control service. So it's asking for my namespace. That's Wade Tech Ed. So copy this. And then it's asking for the realm that I just created. And I think I remember it, but just to be safe, I'm going to copy it as well. Whoa. There we go. So we'll add that realm. Now, so we specify those resources. We want to make sure that when the phone app starts, it immediately goes to the login page. So we're going to come up here to, if I can click, the app manifest file. And instead of loading the main page, we're going to load pages login page. And then upon successful login, we want it to redirect back to the main page. So just a few things to update here, not much. I feel like pointing out, too, there's... many different ways you can approach this. You can actually build an application that hits the main page first that has a login link, and when you click the login link, then it goes to the login page, etc. I'm keeping it simple here and just always forcing people to log in right away, but there's a number of different ways that you can approach it. Go ahead and build, and we'll run. So all this is doing right now is it's going to open up the page, let me log in, and then it's going to redirect me back. You can see here here's the three different identity providers that I selected. What's interesting is because this is managed at the access control service, if after I've released this app to market, I wanted to get rid of an identity provider or even add a new one, I never have to redeploy my app. All I need to do is just go to the management service for access control and add a new identity provider or remove it. So it gives me a lot of flexibility there. I'm going to go ahead and use my Google account. And wherever page up is, there we go. WadeDemo@gmail.com. Yeah, there's no way for me to hide that. I apologize. Let's see if I can type it right. All right, so this is the first time I'm hitting this access control service, service namespace. So by default, and this is very common, the user has to accept or allow the access control service to be an authorized relying party, so to delegate that off. So I'm going to say go ahead and allow. That is something that a user would end up having to do, and voila, that exists. I just realized I missed something because I wanted to show you that I actually have a token. So let me come back here to the main page and come here and create a loaded event. And I think, aren't snippets great? So what this is doing is essentially grabbing out of the application resources my simple web token from the store, casting it as a simple web token store, and then I'm just going to say message box show a simple web token dot simple web token dot raw token. All right, I'll do that one more time. If you guys noticed, when I logged into Gmail, I actually said to remember my login. So, that was a little faster than I meant to. Let me do it again. Choose Google, and then boom, here's the message box. So this is the token that I am getting back from the access control service. It may look like gobbledygook, but when you start interacting, this is an OAuth token. Essentially, we're going to be able to pass this to our service after we append a bearer name to it, and our service is going to be able to start leveraging this. So this is great. This is really exciting. At least I don't know if you guys are excited, but I'm excited. So we've got our phone set up. Now what we're going to do is we're going to create a set of services. I'm going to create a new MVC4 web app, and I'm going to use the web API, but the new web API is a new template that's provided along with ASP.NET 4 MVC. I think I said that right. One of the things I first do is pretty much start deleting everything. So I'm going to get rid of those things. I'm going to get rid of those controllers. Get rid of all of this. And I think I'm going to have to update and get rid of these guys as well. All right, so got a very simple web API. So I'm going to go ahead and create a new controller. And I don't know I'm a very avid homebrewer and aspiring micro. I want to one day open a microbrewery. So I'm going to create a beer controller, and I'm going to create a service that returns back some beer recommendations. And I'm going to, by default, create an API controller with empty read-write actions. So go ahead and add this. And I'm going to say, you should definitely drink Pliny the Younger. Arrogant Bastard is good. What else? Anyone have a beer of choice that I should add here? Fishhead. I heard that. I love Fishhead. That's good. Purple Haze. Yes. All right. That's good. So grab that service. And a couple other things I need to do. Come back here and I think register routes. Here are my routes. And then I put a note here because I can't ever remember this one. Route table dot routes. And then, did I add this already? I think, was it all routes? No, routes. Does anyone remember? I'm blanking. Route table. Does anyone remember? I definitely want to call register routes. Table.routes. There we go. Okay. Register routes, route table routes. Sorry about that. Okay. So basically what this is just doing is saying, hey, let's create a map and HTTP role so that when we address it, it's going to be API slash the controller name and then an ID. So apologies. A little bit of a brain fart there. So basically now, what I'm going to do is I've got a service. It's not secured yet, but what I'm going to do is let's go ahead and go back to our phone app and take this in steps. So what we're going to do is call to this service and get back the data that we want. So I do have, if I can type here. All right, so that's a lot of code, but let me comment that out. We'll get to that in a moment, and basically what we're doing here is we're going to have an address URL that we address. So let's come here and make sure we're addressing the right port. So under web. And then it's API beer. And we'll do a web request create. Now, the best practice for a phone is you always want to run this asynchronously. So that this is why we have it set up this way. And we're going to create our request, async request. We'll get the response. And then basically we'll get the response stream from it. And then we're going to deserialize the object using a simple JSON. And simple JSON is a great NuGet package. So I'm going to do a install package simple JSON. It just makes deserializing JSON awesome. It works on the Windows phone. Basically almost anywhere. And we'll deserialize that object, and then in our page, let's go ahead and create a list. We're getting to the good stuff here in a moment, I promise. So, list box. All right. So, at this point, unless I made a mistake, we should be able to run this. Let me just review. Yep. All right, so let's start our service. And then we'll run our phone app. And if all goes well, oh, I forgot to take the message out, sorry. Okay, there we go. So we got back from our service. Basically, it returned a JSON object with all these in there, and then it just cast it as a list of strings, and we're attaching it to the list box. So that's great. So now what we want to do is secure this, because you know this is a very select, only a select group of people can get access to my beer recommendation. So I don't want just anyone to be able to hit the service. So what I'm going to do is add a delegating handler, an MVC, to essentially get called before the message context is processed and take a look at whether or not the header has an authorization token in it. And if it does, validate whether or not that's a good token. So let's see. So delegate, global configure, global. There we go. So what here is, this is essentially how you add a message handler. So I'm going to add a new message handler and call it token validation handler. And that doesn't exist, so I'm going to go ahead and create it. And the token validation handler is of delegating handler, which is part of systemnet HTTP. And then what we're going to do is override the send async method. So basically, all right, so this is really, this is a method that we're overriding, send async. We're going to be able to get the request message out of there. So we're actually going to be able to inspect the header to see if we actually have the authorization header that we want to validate that user. So we've got that. So now what we want to do is let's grab the auth header. I'll show you, I do have a bug in here, but just I apologize. But basically what we're going to do is grab the authorization header out of it. Now, when you pass in an auth token, by default, you have to specify the bearer. You have to name the bearer. So basically, we're saying that this is an OAuth token. So the very first thing we're going to do is, to get the token, we essentially need to remove the bearer from the token so that we actually just get the value of the token. So that's what this code is right here. And then essentially, it's going to say, hey, if the OAuth doesn't exist, let's go ahead and throw an HTTP exception. So my bug here, by the way, is I'm not catching on whether or not there is or isn't an authorization header. So if I were to run this, it would never get down here and throw an exception like it's supposed to. So apologies. I will update this in my GitHub repo where I've got this deployed. So I'm essentially going to just go ahead and cheat a little bit and go ahead and add a blank request header of authorization. You wouldn't typically do this, but this is just because there we go. So at least now it won't throw an exception. All right. So essentially what's happening now is, you know, if I go to run this, it's going to check for that. Now, it's going to check to see if the token exists. We also want to validate that there is valid token. And there's a couple of things that need to be done here. And there is a NuGet package that makes this really easy that Matthias Wolski has thrown together. And it's brilliant. And I'll show you that to you in a moment. So it's from auth10.simplewebtoken. Oops, auth10. Let's choose the right project and try again. And so here you'll see the simple web token validator. And when you use the validator, what it's going to do when you call validate is it walks through and, you know, first checks to make sure there's a token, makes sure that it can create a simple web token out of it, that it's got a key, security key. And this is what I think is the real magic, is it does an HMAC comparison on it. And essentially what this is, it's worth spending a moment on, is when you, along with the token, you pass a hash. And that hash is a Base64 hash that was given to you by the access control service that represents a calculated value of all the stuff that was passed back. So it's a secure hash. What happens is you embed that as part of the token so that when you make the call to the access control service, you can validate that it is the actual token that came back. And to do this, basically, we're gonna generate it using that hash that the access control service also uses, create the hash out of the data that was provided, and then make sure that they're equivalent and equal. And if they end up being equal, then you know that the token that was given to you was actually passed to you by the access control service. So this is the is HMAC valid. And for this to work, essentially what I need to do is write some code here. So I think I've got it under validator. So I'm essentially creating a simple web token validator, and I'm going to give it the token that the access control service uses. I can get this from coming to certificates and keys and get the Wade TechEd, grab that key right there. And so this is what it's going to do to sign and create, or to essentially create that hash locally and then compare with what the access control service token gave us. So we'll go ahead and run this now. The way it's set up is, I haven't updated my phone to pass in the token, so this will fail. So let's run it real quick, and we'll see that the phone won't be able to get access to it. And I will put a breakpoint in there so we can walk through this process. All right. There's the token. I wasn't supposed to do that. All right, let me just skip. We'll do this instead. One more time. All right, I'm just going to skip to the chase and pass in the token, and we'll walk through it. All right, we'll use Google again. Here's the token. All right, so here we've gotten through it. You can see we were able to validate that there was a token. It removed the bearer name on it, so it removed OAuth. And so now I have my token, and I'm going to go ahead and walk through and validate that token. So let's step through this. The token isn't null, so that works. It is a simple web token, so it can actually load that. It has a security key, and you can see here it's loaded it up. And then here's the HMAC valid. So we're going to come through here and generate a local version of that signature and then compare with what was passed along in the token. And if it returns true, it does. So we have a valid token. It's not expired. And this last part I'm not using at the moment, but you can create different types of audiences so that you can authorize different URIs or different endpoints. And so this library allows you to account for that as well. So all of that looks good. Let me go ahead and run through, and you can see I can get access to those values that come back from that API. So I hope a couple of those little bumps didn't take away from what it was demonstrating. I'll reiterate again. We On the phone, we're able to log into the access control service and get a token back that represents our identity. When we then call this web API, we're passing the token in, and the web API is going to intercept that with the delegating handler, and before it ever tries to return a response back, it's going to make sure that that's a valid ACS token, and that we have or should be able or were authorized to get back the results from this API, and if so, then it will end up going ahead and returning the results to us. So it's actually a very simple way to secure your web APIs and get access to them from your application. Was there a question? Oh, my last name is... my last name is Wegner, W-E-G-N-E-R. And actually, the best way to reach me is my blog, wadewegner.com, and all my contact info is there. So... Okay, so I just noticed that I've got 10 minutes left, and I've got so much more to tell you about. So let's get back to the demo. All right, if I can find my clicker. So I hope that was interesting. I think using identity from mobile and phone has certainly been something that I've heard a lot from the community as being difficult. And I think this, you know, there's definitely some code here, but it's actually pretty straightforward. All right, so very quickly, two different types of communications typically seen with devices. One is device-initiated, where you're going out and calling to a service, just like we did with that to get our beer list. Another is cloud-initiated, and you can think of this as push notifications. Device-initiated, I'm just going to skip through this real quick. You guys know the biggest and most important thing to think about is your payload on the response, because phones are on cellular networks that don't have a lot of data. This just shows you this is the same data being passed back to the phone using a different format. OData on the left, just plain old REST XML, and then JSON. And the payload size is night and day. So whenever you can, you talk over the web using JSON. You're going to have a lot more performance. Push notifications are a great way to interact with the device. So with the Windows Phone, you have the ability to send a raw message right into the app. You can send a tile update where it actually updates images or counts or title. Or you can send down a toast to the device where it will actually, you know, it's kind of like getting a text. You'll get a toast message at the top. The pattern is actually pretty straightforward, but there are a couple of steps, and it's worth talking through it real quick. Before you ever send a notification to the device, the application on the device actually has to register a channel that allows your service that you build to send the message to the device. So your app will first make a call out to the notification service. In this case, it's the Microsoft Push Notification Service. This is a service that Microsoft provides. You will then request a channel URI that will get sent back to you. And that channel URI is specific to your device and this application. And essentially, it's a URI. What you're going to do is take that URI and send it to your service so that you can then store that URI in either like SQL Azure or a table. And you want to store that because you want to have that channel available so that when you want to send a notification to your application running on someone's device, you have the channel URI in hand already. So this gets done ahead of time. Essentially, this usually happens when the app is opened for the first time. Someone opts into creating a channel URI. Now, once that's done, your app now has a URI that it can use to send a message to the device. You can then use that URI, generate a message, send it to the notification service, and the notification service is the one that sends it to the device. And this is important because to reduce the wear on a battery, to reduce network congestion and so forth, push notifications almost always originate from the notification service that's tied to the phone platform. So within Windows Phone, it's the Microsoft Push Notification Service. If you're building for iPhone or iPad, you're using the Apple Push Notification Service, APNS. If you're building for Android, you're using C2DM. So each of these platforms has it. In fact, Windows 8 has its own notification service as well, and that's the Windows Notification Service, or WNS. So your app doesn't push directly to the client. It's the notification service does. You just use the channel URI to do that. I think I just went through all of that. I'm sorry. There's an interesting pattern that comes out of this, because typically the notification message that you send to the device is a very small payload, so you can't send a whole lot of information into it sometimes. So you can end up using this as a way to initiate a client call to your service. So consider the fact that you want, let's say, an application to pull down an updated XML that it uses locally or something like that. You can send a push notification that triggers an action on the device. The user clicks it, it sends some sort of a signal to then make a call to a service that you have, where then you can send a response back into the service. So this could be a way to get a very large file. This could be a way to update some data that you use locally that you want to cache that updates some values in the app. It can be a number of different things. But there's a way to use a push notification to initiate a device call to your service. And this pattern is actually very popular. Here are the different services that I mentioned. Like for each platform, there is a notification service that you can tie into. And in the 5 minutes I have left, I'm going to show you a very quick demo. All right, this one should be pretty quick. So I'm not going to go ahead and deploy this one. So I'm going to create a new Windows Phone app. And let's see. On the device, I'm going to install a NuGet package. Windows Phone dot notification. Phone dot notification base page. All right. So what this is doing is it's bringing down all the things that I need on the phone in order to both initiate and generate the channel URI and then get all this stuff to work. So let me update a couple of things because I'm going to have it open up this notification page directly. And I'm trying to go fast and hopefully I don't make a mistake. All right, I think that's all I need to do here. I'm not going to change the initializer, so we're good. Okay, so that's it for the client side right now. I'm going to also go ahead and create a web MVC project. And I'm going to use IS Express on it. All right. And in here, I'm going to go ahead and install another set of resources. So basically, there are NuGet packages that will take the channel URI that's generated and store it in storage so that you have access to it within your application. So install package, Windows Phone, .notifications. Windows Azure dot notifications. So I actually built these. You'd think I'd be able to remember them. All right, so we install Windows Azure notifications. So this is really just all the services. So you're not going to actually see any UI on top of this. This is really just the services that the phone ends up communicating with. So we'll go ahead and do that, get that. And then since we want to have some sort of a UI to generate the notifications, we also built some scaffolding for that. So this is Windows Phone, .notifications.management sample, UI sample. So, oops, I should hit enter. Now, one thing I need to do real quick is, once it's installed, okay, build it, and let's figure out what port this is running on. Actually, cancel that. Huh. Oh, here, let me run it. So if I then go notifications. Yeah, sorry. When I did that, it changed. I want to use IS Express, and when I made that change, it changed it. So 12.380. Okay, so I won't try to change it at 12.380. I'm going to come here, and we want to make sure that here it is. 12, when I said 12.380, right? 12.380. All right. So we're updating that at the endpoint that it's going to talk to. All right, now let's give it a try. I shouldn't have to do anything else, so apologies for this taking so long. All right, so here's the scaffolding we can use. Now let's go ahead and run our application. This is pretty cool, so hopefully you guys, I think it's cool anyway. Oh no. Did I? Pages notification. Notifications page. Jeez. All right, so first thing we need to do is request a channel URI. So we're going to request the channel URI. It's going to get that from MPNS, and then it's going to store it. The host name is bad. All right, well, apologies. Essentially what it would show is, I don't know why it's missing it, but basically it's going to request it here, and I would be able to send the notifications down to the device. So apology about the demo gremlins, but you guys take a look at it. There's some other resources. I'll go ahead and just quickly wrap up here. I have been giving that demo for years and never had it fail. So we've gone through all we've also talked about these platform services. ACS we went through. There's a caching service that's great. Traffic manager for global data centers and routing across the data centers. CDN and then data sync. There are toolkits for all three of the major platforms. Yes, I did call Windows Phone one of the three major platforms. iOS and Android. And you can use that to get a jump start on everything. And I hope that helped. We went a little bit longer on some of the things, especially ACS and managing identity and tokens. But hopefully that was useful. And I appreciate your time and thank you very much.